Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to this special episode of the Red Box podcast from The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. Today I'm joined by historian and biographer Sir Anthony Seldon, author of works on Churchill, Major, Blair and Cameron, and more unusually, biographies of key political buildings, including Number 10, the Foreign Office and the British Ambassador's residence in Washington. More recently, he's published a history of the Cabinet Office, examining the relationship between officials and their elected masters over the past century. So here we are then, 6 months after Theresa May entered Number 10. We're learning more about her style of leadership and the fractious relationship with officials like Sir Ivan Rogers, the EU diplomat, who dramatically resigned over Christmas, and Simon Stevens, the NHS chief, embroiled in a public row over funding for the struggling health service. So Anthony, I'd like to begin with a question we posed in our last podcast. Does Theresa May know what she's doing?
Yes, I think she does know what she's doing. But let's be honest about it. She didn't expect to become Prime Minister when she did. And then all the talk was her taking over in October of last year. And she suddenly found herself taking over before. So she had no time to prepare and work up her staff and work up her policies. I think that, you know, really, really is significant. It wasn't as if she was taking over after a general election and with time to work up her manifesto. And I think the other point is that, obviously, this is such a massively important, unknowable event that we're dealing with, Brexit, in which informed opinion is so deeply divided, as we saw during the referendum. So I think it's a little bit cheap, isn't it, to say that she doesn't know her own mind. And I think it's quite refreshing, actually, having a prime minister who is not obviously ideological and who is prepared just to not be hurried.
How different will she have found it on a sort of day-to-day operational basis, moving from the Home Office to Number 10?
Nothing but nothing in British politics prepares you for being Prime Minister. You can have been Foreign Secretary and Chancellor and Home Secretary, as, for example, Jim Callaghan was, who became Prime Minister 40 years ago. But nothing prepares you for the absolute frantic rush of policy from all areas and the acute difficulty to keep on top and to keep consistency. It takes most prime ministers 3 or 4 years to learn how to do the job. It did Thatcher. It wasn't Richard Thatcher's second term, post Falklands War in 82, post general election victory in 83, that she really got into her stride. It took Blair until the second term till he found his way around, ditto with Major I think a tragedy for the country and for Cameron was he was really beginning to find out how to do the job when he was ejected. So, you know, I mean, she's been there six months, she wasn't expecting to be there, and she's facing the biggest crisis, biggest policy decision since the Second World War. And surprise, surprise, everyone says she is startled like a rabbit in the headlights. Well, what, you know, she isn't, but what else would you expect?
Is the best preparation for going to number 10 being a leader of the opposition? Because at least you sort of, you're sort of having a dress rehearsal in terms of constructing your team and all of that sort of thing.
It's acutely difficult because you're having to cover every single piece of the waterfront. Mm. There is nothing that, whether it's roads or whether it's national insurance or education or Cyprus, that you don't have to have a view on. Therefore, being shadow opposition leader helps, but you're not getting the intelligence briefings, and intelligence takes a very major part of the Prime Minister's time, particularly at the moment that we are facing this existential threat from militant Islam. And on top of that, it's the fact that she is also the country's leading. You're the national leader in this country, so any crisis or emergency, the spotlight's on the Prime Minister, and you have she's the leader abroad, and one of the things they find acutely difficult is the constant treadmill of seeing foreign ambassadors, foreign leaders coming through, and it's very hard to get control, to control your diary, to think through what you're trying to do when you have all this happening and when the media are constantly prying in to see what you are up to. So you have to be psychologically very well adjusted, and it takes 3 to 4 years.
And at the moment, she's sort of been trying to learn on the job and get to grips with all that while the country is facing the biggest policy challenge it's probably ever faced, a sort of single...
Ever. I think that it's acutely difficult because get it wrong and the economy could be very severely damaged. It's acutely difficult because she has such a divided nation with such polarised opinion. It's not just popular opinion, it's expert opinion, so deeply divided about what is the right course of action. And where she has her own party, which has been predominantly Eurosceptic for 40 years, militantly Eurosceptic, nasty, I mean aggressively, don't use nasty, aggressively Eurosceptic, and which has unseated Major and everybody since, and with a predominantly Eurosceptic press. So it is very difficult. And I think she's playing it right. She's not being bounced into decisions. She's given now her second philosophical speech. Some people won't like that because it's too social market, too social democrat for some, envisaging the role of a bigger role for the state. So that's very un-Thatcherite. It's even slightly left of Cameron, who himself was to the left of both Major and Thatcher. But she's come out with these statements. She's dealing incrementally with policy. And if I was giving her advice, I would tell her absolutely to ignore the people who are saying she doesn't know what she's doing.
Have you been surprised by the amount of attention on Fiona Hill and Nick Timothy, the Prime Minister's joint chiefs of staff? Because certainly when David Cameron entered number 10, I'm not sure Ed Llewellyn... I'm not sure his press coverage was quite so fulsome. And sort of every decision, or particularly anything controversial which comes out of number 10 or anything about the relationships with other civil servants especially, all end up being seen actually not through the prism of their relationship with Theresa May, but their relationship with Nick and Fiona.
Well, the reality is that most prime ministers since Thatcher have had a man and a woman in charge of as dominant forces in number 10. So with Thatcher, it was Bernard Ingham, who was covering the press, and Charles Poole, who covered the whole, though he was just Foreign Affairs Private Secretary, he was far more powerful than the principal private secretary, covering the whole waterfront of policy. With Major, it was Sarah Hogg and Jonathan Hill, and actually they had quite a lot of exposure during their time. With Thatcher, it was Angie Hunter and Alistair, and then it was Sally Morgan and Jonathan Powell took over that role. So it's fairly well. And with Cameron, less high profile, but you had Ed Llewellyn and Kate Fall, and but a broader based team. I think it partly reflects the fact that they were the people who were by her side in the Home Office, and she didn't have, it wasn't just she didn't have time to think through what she was going to do across the piece as the Prime Minister needs to do, but she didn't have time to build up a team, and so you fall back on the two people you've known and trusted and worked very closely with, and they were a formidable team. I mean, you know, she wouldn't have lasted as long. I mean, that was extraordinary, the last 6 years at the Home Office, the graveyard of British politicians, if she didn't have really strong people by her side. So I think that inevitably she has relied on those, but I think what's now happened is she's getting a much broader team, much broader policy team, much broader comms team, much broader political team, and the civil servants have expanded into that space and provided the ballast and continuity, and she's got in Jeremy Hayward, the most formidably experienced official, I mean, the dominant official of the last 20 years in British government. So, I don't think it's surprising that people have concentrated on Nick and Fee, and I think in the early months that was the reality because they were, because she was having to rely on them, but now she's built up a team, and therefore they can come back more into the more traditional roles that, you know, has gone all the way back to Thatcher. You know, British prime ministers in Number 10 have two dominant officials on whom they rely. It's a clearly established pattern, as I've shown.
Do you think that she needs to broaden the people that she listens to, the advice that she takes, and to maybe move beyond the sort of bunker mentality that we sometimes saw from the when they were at the Home Office? You know, that was one of the reasons why she survived. You can't run Number 10 thinking everybody's out to get you.
We have very short memories, and it doesn't get any credence to say it, but nevertheless it's true that every Prime Minister is accused for having a bunker mentality. So Thatcher was accused for bunker mentality with Ingham and Charles Pole. Blair, who's a major, was absolutely... and indeed, they talked about it. They talked at one stage in one of their diaries, which I quoted in my book on Major. They felt as if they were in that scene in Zulu where they were surrounded, Rorke's Drift, and they just had this circling enemies all around them. And one by one, you know, bunker mentality was what the Major's team felt, that obviously with the Den under Blair, Brown was hugely criticised for having his close clique of Stuart Wood and Sunai, David Muir in there, you know, again, Cameron's chumocracy. So I has now expanded out. So I think it was inevitably true for the first 3 or 4 months. I think now they brought in, as they needed to do, really strong people to fill in the spaces. But, you know, I mean, prime ministers need to listen and not listen. Prime ministers listen too much, end up going nowhere, and you don't listen at all. The general tendency is all of them, you know, they come in, Blair at the beginning said, you know, call me Tony and, you know, I'm your mate. And Cameron said, call me Dave. And, you know, Thatcher said, call me Margaret, joke. but, you know, the tendency and Major's first cabinet in November 1990 was, you know, incredibly relaxed. They all start off relaxed, wanting to be friends with everybody, and they all end up, you know, like their Rorke's Drift in Zulu. And all of them without fail. And so I think that, you know, there's that pivotal point whereby you are listening, but not listening too much, because, you know, leadership is about taking decisions, and that means you're going to make enemies, and it means you take the right decision at the right time. And I think she's to be praised. Most people think she's to be condemned for keeping her cards close to her chest and not being bounced into decisions. Any, you know, you look at the history of premiership in the last 25 years, many people have gone, prime ministers have gone wrong by feeling the need to make a quick decision. You know, again and again, you have policy on the hoof because the media is baying for a resignation or they're baying for a quick response, and invariably it's wrong. You know, it suits the media for 24 hours, but it doesn't suit the country.
In your book, you talk about how the Cabinet Office in general and the Cabinet Secretary in particular, where they play a really central role in the government, they tend to be the more successful ones, and it's prime ministers who...
Matt, it is absolutely crystal clear that if you look at the history of the last 100 years, the prime ministers who have been most successful, and I will just spell them out. It would be Lloyd George for his 2 years of the war, 1916 to 18, Churchill during the war, Clement Attlee during the Second World War, Churchill. Clement Attlee from 1945 in particular to 49, he lost it in his last couple of years. And you then look at Thatcher until 87, 88 when she lost it. You look at the first two or three Cameron years, which were extremely successful against the odds. These are people who work with their cabinet secretaries and with the wider civil servants. The times it's gone disastrously wrong are where they haven't. And you can look there at Ramsay MacDonald, Labour's first prime minister. You can look at transparently at the Harold Wilson government, particularly from 1966 onwards, when he came back with a majority of 100, but could have had the world before him, had the intellectual popular climate in his favour, but they, none of them, or too few of them, knew how to operate with their civil servants. Richard Crossman, who wrote his diaries with the supposition that it was civil service all at fault. Actually, he was just a crap minister. and Wilson was a crap prime minister. He did not. He brought in a shockingly poor senior civil servant into number 10 because he didn't want to have a robust, cutting-edge treasury civil servant, which is what the principal private secretary normally is. You fast forward to Thatcher, who lost the plot in her last couple of years. Robin Butler, who had been a feisty principal private secretary to her from 1983 to 85, been with her during the Brighton bomb attack in 1984 by her side. I quote in the letter, a very emotional letter in the book, a very emotional letter that Robin Butler wrote to her in 1985 when he stood down as her principal private secretary, came back. She then chose him in 1987 over the outgoing cabinet secretary, Robert Armstrong's advice, who favoured an older person, Clive Whitmore, to take over as cabinet secretary. She said, no, I want Robin Butler. He was fantastic as my principal private secretary. And Robin Butler just couldn't believe how she had changed and how she was no longer working within the norms of cabinet government and the civil service. Blair totally came in with a profound suspicion of the civil servants, a lot of it coming from Jonathan Powell, a lot of it coming from Alistair Campbell, and they trashed the civil servants. So Robin Butler, one of the most long-serving, respected, working for people of both political parties and all political ideas, was trashed. They called him old Buttleshanks. Then they had someone called Richard Wilson, who was a very distinguished civil servant, who they disregarded. Then they brought in somebody else. They were choosing these people. They can't say that these were bad. You know, they imposed them. They chose these people. They then chose Andrew Turnbull, who again they completely sidelined. Andrew Turnbull was barely anything to do at all with the Iraq fiasco. They relied instead on people who they liked and who they trusted. Terribly dangerous, terribly dangerous. So, the lesson's very clear that that one of the great bulwarks of democracy in this country is an impartial civil service. Now, civil servants sometimes get it wrong. Ministers sometimes get it wrong. Ministers get it wrong when they trash civil servants and ignore their advice because they're not telling them what they want to hear. And civil servants get it wrong when they think that they're the masters. They're not. They are civil servants. They are the servants of the country. And they are there as the people who are the expert on their particular policy area. They spent their life, or best part of their life, studying those areas and problems, and they are there simply to deliver. They propose options, they listen to what the minister says, and then whatever the minister says, they get on with it. And so it can go wrong on both sides. But when it goes well, we've had the best government. When it hasn't gone well, we've had the worst.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We've seen in the just past couple of weeks, it was Ivan Rogers who, in his extraordinary resignation email, basically made clear that he felt his advice wasn't being listened to. And then we've had Simon Stevens, head of the NHS, is talking about, you know, he basically making clear he thinks that the NHS needs more money and feels that that isn't being listened to. How dangerous is it for a Prime Minister when senior people like that go public with the idea that their voice hasn't been listened to?
Well, Ivan Rogers didn't go public. I didn't even know how it was leaked. I think that was a clear case of needing to have somebody in that job who was sympathetic with what was happening with Brexit, regardless of what one might think about Brexit. And Ivan Rogers, the world is very much as we conceive it, construe it to be. And if we say something is going to be a terrible problem, it becomes a terrible problem. if we say, this is supremely difficult, but actually we can get around this, that is the skill of the civil servant. If that was what Ivan Rogers was saying, then Ivan Rogers needed to go, and there needed to be somebody else leading that, albeit somebody who didn't know the personalities and the issues as well, who'd come in and actually deliver. Because the job of a civil servant is to be the servant of democracy, of the elected element in our constitution, and they have to do that. And that is completely clear. And it's completely clear that where the civil servants do that, even if they don't agree with what the minister is saying, they put up their arguments, they say the X, Y, Z, but at the end of the day, they simply have to get on with it. And if they are not prepared to do that, they have to resign or they have to be fired. Because that is simply, you know, any more than in the military. You can't have forces in the military saying, well, you know, sorry, I'm not going to go over the top, pat and stop. You know, I mean, this Hague guy, who is he? You know, he's crazy. I don't like his you know, his smexit, some exit strategy, you know, and I'm not going to go. You know, you have to. You can, the officers raise their objections to the plan, but at the end of the day, you know, it was the political masters here in London who were directing the affairs, and they are in the same position. So these are civil servants, not military servants, who are the servicemen and women in this country. So I think it's probably quite healthy that this has come out into the open, and it provides a chance to reboot it, the way that we are approaching it, so there can be people there who, whatever they might think personally, are prepared to make it happen. There is no doubt that we can talk ourselves into thinking that Brexit is going to be impossible. By the way, I voted Remain, but we can absolutely have a Brexit strategy that is going to work for this country, but needs to be delivered by people who believe it's possible, even if they have reservations about the policy, because then it will be delivered. Simon Stevens is a different case, and Simon Stevens he was there in the Tony Blair policy unit. He understands the NHS better than anybody else. And in the country, he is profoundly, profoundly knowledgeable about the way that it works best. And there is a different relationship between Public Health England and so and a diplomat in the FCO. So Slightly different principles apply there. And because of the way that, as you know, NHS England was constituted, and so he has more freedom to express what he thinks is right for the country.
With that case specifically, there is a risk that if it becomes a spat between the NHS and the politicians, the public are more likely to, because, you know, there's this public outpouring always for the NHS, to side with the NHS rather than the politicians. It's got a, getting involved in a public row with the head of the NHS is quite a high risk strategy.
As we've known for many, many years, you cannot be seen to be going against the NHS, which, by the way, is highly inefficient. Mm. And which is ripe for reorganisation and for all the, you know, we all genuflect, don't we? And we say that it does wonderful work, and it's absolutely true. And I know that from personal experience. But there's also, the NHS is very conscious of its power over politicians because of the leverage that it has with the public and the sympathy vote, and I think there's something a little dishonest about the way that the NHS has operated. It does need to be more efficient, more responsive. I think it needs to be more patient, orientated. You know, we all need to be, you know, focused on the customer. The bill that Joe Johnson's trying to get through, that the Lords are protesting about, is very much consumer orientated for the student. It's trying to put the student first. And the NHS, we should all be trying to put the patient first. We shouldn't be, it's not about the doctors, the nurses, the administrators. It's always about the patient and what's in the best interest of the patient. And absolutely not certain that the vociferous leaders of the NHS put that first.
So when Theresa May is sitting in number 10 at the moment, do you think she, is the task that she faces sort of too big? Is it the 24-hour nature of leading a political party with a small majority, running a government facing crisis at home? You've got Brexit, we haven't even touched on Donald Trump. Is it just a job which is impossible to do brilliantly well?
Yes, I think that's very perceptive. I think that's a very fair comment. We don't see it in those terms because we always think that every new incumbent, not least because they promise us the earth, is going to be able to deliver all of this. But if we do look back at prime ministers, well, you know, some people now say to Theresa May isn't, you know, doesn't know her own mind. And then there was that David Cameron. Well, he was useless, wasn't he? And, you know, and then before him, Gordon Brown. What a disaster! And then there was Blair, lying Blair. Iraq and deceit and money. And then there was Major. Well, he was completely useless, wasn't he? And then there was Thatcher. Well, she went mad at the end. And
that's how it goes on. It's the same view of everyone.
And Callaghan, well, he was useless. You know, crisis, what crisis? And the IMF crisis. And Wilson was, so it's extraordinarily hard to get out. I mean, again, it would have been very interesting, as I spoke about with David Cameron, you know, had he won the referendum and had he stayed on another couple of years, which is probably what he would have done, he then would have been extraordinarily the prime minister who had left at the moment of his own choosing, that nobody does. Yeah. Nobody leaves at the moment of their own choosing. People say that Wilson did in 76, but Wilson was already, you know, absolutely, it was going very wrong for him. He got Alzheimer's, he was drinking too much. Yes, he said he was going to do 2 years, but you know, he was very ineffective and was being pushed. So I think that it's very, you know, I mean, most of these people are pushed out, but Cameron would have gone into Memphis own choosing. He would have won two general elections, or not lost them in 2000, emerged as prime minister after two general elections in 10 and 15. He'd have won three referendums. He'd have seen the party through a coalition and as a conservative leader, he'd have got the party to some position of accord on Europe, strengthen the economy, would have been extraordinary. I mean, and would have been the leader of the free world after Obama and assuming Merkel goes, and you know, could have done extraordinary, and had all these plans. So, you know, it was, the stakes for that man were really pretty high. So I think that Theresa May, if she is able to get a sensible way forward on Brexit that's very different from doing what the screaming newspapers are demanding, that she wailing like banshees and her own demented right-wingers are, you know, she'd do very well simply to totally ignore, and not everybody in press is a screaming banshee, and not everyone in the Conservative Party is either, but, you know, significant numbers.
They're the noisiest. Do you think she has a sort of, maybe advantage is the wrong word, but the nature of the way she took office, having not really promised anything, she didn't arrive with a great prime minister to win elections and promise the earth, and then sort of disappointment can only follow. Actually, her quite calm, sort of steadied, unshowy, actually didn't because there was no leadership contest, she didn't really promise anything. She's promised competence, she's promised Brexit means Brexit, but what does that mean? That actually means that the chance of a public backlash against, well, you've not done what you said you're going to do. That actually...
Well, you say that, although some would say that her speech on Monday with the Shared Society, building on her party conference speech, building on her initial comments, are nevertheless painting a picture of a more interventionist state, of a more Joe Chamberlainite One Nation state than some of her predecessors. So, yes, she has in some ways promised less, because she didn't need to, because the fact of elections is you need to promise the earth and then you deliver, you know, little pots of sand. This is true the world over. It's the way the system works, and we merely forget about it from election to election, and we believe that, you know, we're going to, yes, we can, you know, and we can't. You know, the truth is that they can't. And because she didn't have to make these big promises, you know, absolute truth in that.
It'll be interesting to see how it pans out over the coming months. And we've had this sort of period of 6 months of no running commentary, getting to grips with the job, not chasing headlines. But it feels like, particularly when Article 50 is triggered and then we start seeing what's happening in other European countries, the lid might start coming off some of the pressures, and seeing how she copes with those.
Well, I think the risk is that you get bounced into it. Eventually, you get so irritated by people saying, you know, for goodness sake, what do you think about X, Y, Z? So then they start delivering their views on X, Y, Z. And then people applaud for a couple of days and they say, that doesn't make sense. The best advice would be simply just to absolutely ignore. Maybe she could say at some point, you know, the expectations of my job are simply impossible. We need to reboot the public understanding about what the job of the Prime Minister is, because, as the record of my six predecessors show, it is so out of touch with reality about what I could do. But what I will try and do is to do this, this, and this, and if I can do that, you know. So there needs to be this kind of re-education. Meanwhile, there's going to be huge frustration from the political classes. But I think, Matt, that final point on this is that, you know, people are now beginning to say, well, you know, could have been Andrew Benson or whatever. No bloody way. There is no way that anybody who, you know, we talked about the fact that nothing prepares you for the Prime Minister job. Nothing. And you never know till you're there on your own and you've got the nuclear codes and you've got the crisis hitting you left, right, centre, and people screaming in your ears for decisions, and you're very tired and you didn't sleep well last night, and the buck stops with you. The pound stops with you. You never know how you're going to be able to cope, and it's pretty frightening, intensely frightening, actually, for many of them. Nevertheless, she was Home Secretary. She dealt with security and terrorism for 6 years. There's no way that any of the other people... You know, it's the incredible insouciance, the incredible arrogance from so many people that think they could do these jobs when they haven't a bloody clue what the job involves. So she did at least have that experience.
Well, on that final thought, Anthony Seldon, thank you very much. If you enjoyed this podcast, please do post a review on iTunes. And remember to sign up to my morning email briefing.
Yeah, definitely sign up for the briefing. Essential.
The
How
Times.
Can you think about not signing up.
That's the best advert we ever had. thetimes.co.uk/redbox email. But for now, from Anthony Seldon and me, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.